Well, welcome everyone to Professional Practice Management Investments, Current Challenges and Future Opportunities, your webinar today from Winston and Strawn. We are happy to have you join us today. I've got a great group of gentlemen who are going to discuss a whole bunch of issues around physician practice investments and some of the current issues that surround what's doing with these investments as a result of the COVID outbreak, and then some sort of, you know, where we might go once the coast is clear. So again, I'm Ari Markinson. I'm the co-chair of our Healthcare and Life Sciences Industry Group here at the firm. I'm going to have Roy and Steve introduce themselves. Roy, why don't you start with a quick introduction, and then we'll go on to Steve.
Sure, and thank you for inviting me to participate in this. My name is Roy Bejarano. I'm the CEO and founder of Scale Physician Group, a company that my partner and I launched January of 2019. Since our launch, we've been engaged 20 times by a combination of independent physician platforms, some as small as 4 providers, many between 15 and 60 providers, and some as large as 1,000 providers in various states across the country. We've also been engaged by approximately 10 private equity shops to assist them as they either evaluate new investment opportunities into this space or as they review and optimize their existing portfolio company investments in the space. We've also been engaged by a growing number of lenders into the space. Most recently, BMO engaged us on a restructuring of a specialty pharma and infusion asset. And we've also recently been engaged by government entities as well, currently working with the City of Boston on dealing with some of their infected homeless patients. So our company is about 45 individuals with deep expertise in physician practice management, typically as CEOs of various platforms, normally sponsor-backed, but not in every case, who have come together in order to provide a breadth of expertise that's easily accessible and that is multidimensional, which is a little bit different than the pre-existing model of relying on a singular operating partner or relying on strictly full-time management teams on their own to try to tackle the complexities that come up again and again within healthcare services. Stephen, who's on the phone as well, is one of our operating partners, and Ari, if you want, I'll let Stephen give some background on himself.
Sure, Steve, why don't you give a little bit of an introduction?
Sure, good afternoon. My name is Steve Strauss. I've been in the healthcare industry my entire 40-plus year career and have a fairly deep set of experiences, particularly from an operator's point of view, functional as well as several C-suite roles, including chairman and executive chairman roles in multi-site, multi-state facilities. And that includes probably about a dozen different specialties as single specialty operations as well as multi-specialty. And as I mentioned, really looking at physician practice managements and associated facilities through the lens of an operator. And I have worked with and continue to work with several private equity sponsors, lenders, investment bankers, and I sit on a few private equity sponsored physician practice management boards and serve as an executive chairman of one.
Great. Roy, Steve, thank you. Why don't we get right into it? So, Steve, let's start with you. You and I had this conversation last week, which was just a little bit about, you know, I don't want to rehash kind of the nightmare that so many of these practices went through in terms of being, you know, faced with shelter in place orders, because a lot of us have an understanding of that. But what I do want to do is talk a little bit about, you know, once you realize you are going to have a shelter-in-place order and your practice doors had to shut, your outpatient services had to shut, what was the first thing that management team are the first things, right, that management team should have been doing.
Yeah, and I went through this real-time area as an executive chairman, so this is a relevant question for me as well, having lived it recently. There are really four things, and the top two things that management should have been doing, A, number one, conserving every dollar of cash, and secondly, quickly developing a communication plan for key audiences. And we really looked at the audiences in two categories. First audience was obviously the board, the investors, lenders, providers, staff, and patients. And then the second audience included landlords and what I'd say are suppliers or vendors, the medical suppliers, the service suppliers that, you know, include legal counsel, payroll, IT, insurance, marketing, just to name a few. So really identifying and developing a plan for those audiences. And each of those plans, in my mind, are a really needed to include the describing of the closing. Was it a partial closing? Was it a temporary closing? But defining the what of closing. And during that communication plan to these audiences, exhibiting some empathy around acknowledging the health and safety of the audience that's being addressed, as well as the health and safety of their families. But also communicating what preparations, what investments are being made during this temporary closing or scaled down operation. So we're not only scaling down or closing, but during this dormant time, we're preparing and we're making specific investments, and you can cite those, in preparation of reopening. And the other key in this communication plan is just making sure that you send the message that will keep you informed from time to time as we all go forward. And so that's kind of the general messaging, but when you look at each audience, Ari, try to personalize it. You know, there's a different message, obviously, for employees, and talking about eligibility of unemployment benefits and how they apply. To patients, there's a different message. To vendors, there's a different message. So this communication plan development with the right team members in the organization to the right audience is really, really important. And then not to misstating the obvious, but the other two things were just understanding the CARES Act in detail to understand eligibility. Do you decide to apply? When do you apply? And then just staying closely aligned and monitoring federal, state, community, and industry associations and societies on the status of the pandemic. So those are the four things that I was involved with, and a lot of private equity sponsors I work with did the same. And then the two audiences are pretty generally common, despite what specialty you're working in.
Roy, first, a little bit from you on the first thing folks should have been doing.
Yeah, so along with Steve, we've been observing and working with our portfolio platforms that we were engaged with as this was unfolding. So I would say about 10 platforms simultaneously that we were working with, witnessing and participating in the response that each of them had to go through. And for every one of them, the circumstances were a little bit different depending on their geography. You know, the nature of these statewide shutdowns was somewhat sequential. It wasn't all simultaneous. And also the severity of some of the shutdowns were a little bit different from one state to the next. And also the impact, depending on type of specialty, was obviously and remains very different. Derm and dental, GI, uro, reacting differently and affected differently than maybe ER, ICU management, which is considered essential. and some other core essential services that are out there that continue to remain open. And even within these specialties, for different reasons, some groups, some ENT groups lost 70-80% of their revenues, some lost 50% of their revenues. There was definitely variance in impact, but the core themes, I think, remain the same, and I think Stephen has highlighted them very well. I sort of break them down into three or four different groups. So sort of bucket A, which is the initial reaction that a lot of C-suite executives and sponsors focused on first was obviously cash, focusing on cash flow, focusing on maximizing access to capital, perfecting that access to capital, understanding not only your loan financing capabilities, but also how to maximize the value of your existing AR. Even something as simple as the difference between being paid by check via mail and being wired actually was a difference and remains a difference when so much of our infrastructure is hampered. Reserve cash, the non-sponsor-backed platforms, access to equity, and obviously Steve mentioned some of the government financing options, which we'll probably speak about in a little bit more depth, the CARE Act and PPP loans. So this was obviously the first step. I think embedded in that is the what scenario are we looking at? And so as best as possible, building a worst case, you know, what's the worst case for my revenues? Am I down to zero? Am I down to 5%, 15%, 30%? Maybe building a base case and maybe building an upside case and solving for that worst case. And that sort of like brings you into discussions with your FTEs, discussions with your more variable cost partners, your landlords, your suppliers, your AP partners. And those discussions become very critical, as Steve mentioned, handling them with great delicacy, and remembering that if there is another side to this, the return to work, a lot of those partners you'll rely on the back end to quickly come back and get back to business as it was. So furloughing versus firing, or retaining versus furloughing, collective concessions versus too narrowly focused concessions, just communicating where decisions are being made with a high degree of delicacy was well received, and continuing that dialogue. It's certainly understood that everyone across the country is going through a personal experience of this, a family-orientated, a friend-orientated experience, which probably supersedes anything professional. But that the professional component, and that's been one of the eye-opening experiences for me, remains very important to all of us. We have at scale weekly calls with institutional investors that are set up quarterly, but we have so many of them, there isn't a week that goes by that we don't have these calls recurring, or we touch base with the sponsor community. And certainly the number of these calls went down in the middle of all of this, March and early April, but I was surprised at how many sponsors and lenders and bankers continue to dial into these calls to get updates. And I got a lot of comfort on a personal level from peers sharing their experiences with me and vice versa. And I think I took a lesson from that the ongoing touch and feel, even though we can't do it face-to-face, and we do the same with our team here at scale, and we have video calls that are internal, just so we can see each other's faces. These things do make a difference, and there are many ways that you can reach out to your patient base, your staff, your executives, that sort of falls within the realm of delicate and sensitive, but still nonetheless sends the message that nobody's vanished, and the company in question is still very much alive, maybe not as healthy as it used to be, but not planning to go anywhere. So the statement, we're not going anywhere. We're going to be here through thick and thin, and we're going to come back and build again. These are powerful, important statements to share repeatedly during the crisis. I think the return to work, and maybe we'll touch on that, raises a whole slew of additional questions. I will say during the pause, there was sort of a a third component to this. So if the first one was financial and the second was communication, let's say the third component is opportunistic. So looking above and beyond the magnitude of the damage, asking the question, in this changing environment, what can we do to start addressing unmet demand, albeit the nature of that demand is maybe a little bit different, very different, but we're still in healthcare. This is a health crisis. A lot of the services that we provide, some of them are available to be defined as essential today, good. Some may increasingly be defined as essential tomorrow, very good. And what other things can we do with our healthcare constituents, our ecosystem, to become relevant? Change is difficult, but while we have time on our hands, and a lot of our businesses do have access to investment capital and plenty of executive talent, are we having those discussions? Are we organized, and are we looking at unmet demand for testing and unmet demand for personal care and unmet demand for at-home care through telemedicine? And what else can we throw into that list of things that we wouldn't normally have done if business was as usual, but in very unusual circumstances, these things become a lot more relevant.
Sure. Roy, thank you. I've neglected to say to our audience that we'll take questions at the end. I'll leave about 20, 25 minutes or so that we can make sure that everyone has questions. There's a question box in the webinar on screen that you can, throughout the session, add questions to that. And as I said, we'll take them towards the end. Roy, let's circle back to you. And both you and Steve have raised a whole host of issues that we're going to get into a little bit more detail throughout our conversation. But let's circle back to thinking about, we talked about kind of immediate, what are you supposed to do? What are you faced with? But when you push out and think about these practice managers, the management team dealing with 4 weeks, 6 weeks into a shelter in place order with essentially all outpatient services, practically, and in some situations, essentially an entire practice shut down, most significant challenge at that point? Did it change dramatically, just get worse? What do you think?
So certainly if we're talking about this from a financial balance sheet perspective, maybe a month, two, 3 months of forgiveness and forbearance from lenders, to some extent as the months roll by, these conversations become more difficult. I do think a lot of the measures taken in the first month or two in terms of adjusting down your variable costs, and also the magnitude of how this crisis was explained to us day one as being very deep, transformational, probably long-term, I think sort of helped in terms of managing everyone's expectations to some extent. I know there was some confusion, and there still is plenty of confusion about it, how short-term, medium-term, and long-term the impact will be. But certainly planning for a 6, 12-month, 18-month return to normal probably helped a lot of operators manage accordingly. But I think that there are things that continue to certainly be a challenge, not least of which we're not seeing the rapid return of volume in any of the 50 states. From the 30 that are open to the 20 who aren't, there's still a lot of volume that's been heavily disrupted, and the expectation is that it will remain a challenge for months to come. But I think in addition to that, you've seen confusion over what the return to normal looks like from a regulatory and legal standpoint. Our next white paper that we're drafting is going to be focused on trying to unwrap that confusion. What does it mean to have a new standard of care about a safe workplace for your employees and your patients? Not sure that's been very clearly defined for anyone. Suggestions, recommendations from OSHA, a debate between the House and the Senate about including some kind of disclaimer language and waiver on a national and federal level. But expectations are state by state, regulations will be different about what it means to be safe. I think I last heard anecdotally there were 700 lawsuits that have been filed over the last 60 days based on this issue, you know, including groups like Walmart and several hospital systems, I think 250 of them in New York alone. So, I mean, it remains America. It remains a litigious place. And so I think some of that additional, if we're talking about large topics to focus on, a lot of the focus is now shifting on with 30 states opening and the expectation that 20 more will follow at some point. What does it mean to get back to work? Those groups that have donated supplies or have had supplies confiscated, I haven't heard of too many, but obviously they have a whole slew of additional issues to deal with, how to rebuild inventory. You've got a lot to work with in terms of complexity going forward, and that's assuming that schools reopen and your staff can show up to work every day. So, yeah, just some large topics there that we're still wrestling with.
Steve, anything, again, the sort of topic here is, you know, you're 4 weeks or 6 weeks out of a shutdown. You're in a shelter-in-place order. You're you know, issues magnified, different issues, new issues. Any thoughts on that?
Roy did a nice job of covering a lot of the key essential issues. I think what I'd like to do, Ari, is to supplement Roy's comments with focusing on one key challenge, and I'd call that the human element. The fact of the matter, any of us who are in the physician management and healthcare outpatient facility business, we're a service business, and the greatest assets that we have can't be found on the balance sheet. There are people. And the value we deliver to our patients, our clients, our customers comes through our people, through their heads, hands, and hearts. So one of the greatest challenges is to be really in tune with the human capital element of your organization, the internal focus. And from a leadership standpoint, you must remain composed, confident, and organized. And the enormity of this challenge is beyond description. Most of us have never been involved in a pandemic, thank God, before, but as both of you guys mentioned, this touches everybody personally as well as professionally. So it really gets down to leadership and how do you come across? And it takes a lot of courage to be composed and confident and organized. And that's just behavioral stuff. But then it gets back to what Roy and I have said already is communication. And putting your communication plans together and delivering them clearly, concisely, and consistently. And Roy hit a good point on, in that communication, you've got to manage expectations because expectations are all over the map with all different types of audiences within your organization. And as a leadership team, really thinking through and then executing a plan to effectively and authentically manage relationships with your fellow managers, with your board, with your investors, with your lenders. And we talk about staff, but also over-investing time with your leading physicians. If they're just the natural leaders in a clinic in the organization, they're investors, no matter what leadership component the physicians have, they could be a leader just because they're the largest revenue generator. but really making sure you invest ample time in managing and strengthening the relationship with these physicians. And just don't underestimate the relationship value of what I call human capital. And these are stressful and challenging times, and people in all different positions are going to react differently. And I really, really think this pandemic provides us an opportunity to go to a deeper level of trust-based relationships to avoid polarization. We're all humans, and we all possess and exhibit a range of emotions during these challenging times, and following the emotion comes behavior. And, you know, these emotions and behaviors will surface. They are surfacing. You know, they're conveyed, you know, through our vulnerability, our fear, anger, violation of trust. You know, somebody might accuse me of being selfish. Another might have just unbelievably unrealistic expectations. So really working on taking what you think your trust-based relationships are into a deeper level. And it's not about disagreeing more. It's all about alignment among the key stakeholders and letting go of my self-interest for the best interest of the collective team. And this requires sacrifice on everyone's part. So in the service-related space that we're all working in, playing in, not underestimating the importance of spending time in developing and deepening trust-based relationships.
Ari, can I add to that as well?
Sure.
Yeah, I thought it was beautifully put, Stephen. So I agree with every single word, and I would just compliment it by thinking about this as you use the term opportunity. I mean, we could spend forever and a day talking about all the negatives associated with the current crisis, but I'm not sure how that would help us create value for our respective franchises. So it is, I think, far more beneficial to try and convert a crisis into opportunity. And the opportunity is to think holistically about all the different metrics that define a successful response in this environment and try to list them all on a piece of paper. You know, what are the new metrics? If we have an opportunity to step away from annual revenue growth, annual earnings growth, improved margins, return on equity, expanding multiples, and substitute those core metrics that we think about myopically day in, day out, with time and ability, because I think there's a receptive audience out there, a wanting audience of stakeholders that want to think about not just the time that you spend with them, on them, and their feelings, but also time spent on initiatives that were otherwise being ignored because they didn't fall into that core set of metrics that we otherwise focus on. You know, let's have conversations that were cast aside about ownership and what tomorrow will look like and how it might be a little bit different than yesterday. Let's get buy-in from stakeholders and constituents that otherwise weren't being listened to that frequently because they were too busy, we were too busy. They were too busy dealing with patients, we were too busy dealing with lenders. Let's have those conversations. There's a lot of merit that we see time and time again, whether we're working with sponsors, management teams, physicians, and lenders, to conviction, clarity, commitment, and excitement associated with a business plan. And it's amazing how often that conviction goes away because of all the distractions that are out there and the changing nature of our businesses. And so you're left with certain stakeholders that are looking for leadership and aren't necessarily satisfied with what they've been given. And so this again, is an opportunity to get in front of those stakeholders And so you're not just giving me forbearance here because you're giving everyone forbearance here. You're giving me forbearance because I deserve it, because I'm going to earn it, because we have something very good that we're already building towards, recognizing that 99.9% of the populace out there don't believe that where we are today is as bad as things will be a year from now. We can debate 6 months, we can debate a month, but most will agree that by summer of next year, 2021, we'll be busier as a country than we are today, ignoring other catastrophes that haven't yet happened. So there is reason to focus on the business plan and the vision. And I'll throw in another category as well, recognizing that this is one of those historic moments, you know, where you ask yourself, where were you when JFK was assassinated? I wasn't born yet, but for those who are alive, you know, the memory, it clings to large events. I certainly remember exactly what I was doing every minute of every day of September 11th, because I was there. I was at World Trade Center, and I can tell you what I was doing at 8:15 and 8:23 and 8:54. This is one of those moments where conversations that are managed well will be remembered for months and years and lifetimes. Friendships can be really cemented. So I think approaching every outreach with that in mind and not being scared of that, recognizing that we're all human and we're not always going to say exactly the right thing, but just showing up is a big statement. And I think in that context, having your entire team as broadly defined as possible, ask the question, what can we do on a humanitarian basis to help our neighbors, to help our fellow citizens? There's a lot of crazy stuff going on as a response to this pandemic. And we are actually, all of us professionals in the core industry, entrusted with actually primarily dealing with this. This is not a military issue. It's not a economic issue yet. I mean, it's manifesting into one in many ways, but primarily it's been a health issue. And so there have been a lot of very interesting creative responses to being socially progressive and responsive and responsible. So I think that's a big topic too, that if as a metric the answer is we did nothing, that's probably a sign that was a missed opportunity.
Great. Roy, thank you. Let's switch gears a little bit to talk about what some of these management teams have been doing with their physician and professional partners on all the different sources of stimulus funds that have been available to them, sort of who's getting what kinds of funds and how are they using them. Steve, why don't we start with you?
There are several sources of dollars, and they're both at the state and the federal level. And understanding the state unemployment benefits in each state you operate is really important because they vary. And our employees are looking and have looked to us for guidance, for assistance. If they've been furloughed, laid off, whatever, they're in a state of shock and they're fearful and they feel vulnerable. And how can we help them and help ourselves understand what the state is providing in terms of financial benefits during these really, really trying times? And I accentuate understand each state, because there is variability in what each state provides. You know, for example, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts provides on average $1,155 of unemployment benefit on average per week. And then with the federal supplement through the CARES Act, the average is another $600 a week. So helping people understand what's available, are they eligible, and if they are, how to obtain that. Because if people can create some type of financial security cash flow to survive during these tough, tough times, and their employer was helping them secure that funding, that'll go a long, long way in getting these people back and generating even greater loyalty and passion to the businesses we've asked them to be employed in. Also, it's really important to understand the federal types of aid, you know, the difference between a grant and a loan, and what are they used for? Most of this federal money is designed through the PPP for the payroll, you know, plus or minus 75% of the stimulus money must be geared and dedicated and channeled to employees for payroll assistance. And there's a lot of detail. And what period of time does this cover? What type of employee, level of income? Really understanding how this works and the duration of how and when this money needs to be spent to have it qualify as a grant versus a loan. And if it is a loan, what are the terms? And having somebody, ideally in human resources and accounting, keep detailed track of all these different sources so we can account for them and make sure we know what the ledger looks like as we get back to business.
Yeah, I would also, sorry if I can add to that.
Yeah, sure, please.
It's interesting. Some companies going into this will surprise themselves that their April was better than they initially forecasted. Their competence in rationalizing expenses and their discipline in shutting off all AP, all third-party service providers, obviously lenders, did such a good job that they show up at the end of April and they have more cash than they imagined. And they sort of close the books on April and give each other a pat on the back, job well done, company looks strong. But I would urge everyone to not stop there and ask the question, now, who are our partners that have sacrificed and compromised in order for that cash balance to be as strong as it is? And really think through line by line what decisions were made line by line in order to build that cash balance. None of this is relevant if the company is still highly distressed and unable to make even its basic commitments that it needs in order to keep the lights on and meet its minimum revenue obligations. And I think all that is sort of you do whatever you can to handle the business that's showing up and available to be handled today, no doubt. But beyond that, if the exercise is purely to build as much cash as you can possibly build because you're unsure of the future, you have to analogize with the shoppers that sort of bought way too much hand sanitizers and chips and whatever else that they went shopping and went frenzied about during the early stages of this crisis. The mind plays tricks, and we simplify sometimes to our own detriment. And so if there is an opportunity to ask the question, hey, I have a lot of PPP. I was one of the 10 to 14% of small businesses that successfully was issued that loan. I have a lot of cash. I was able to reduce all outflow expenses. Maybe it's time for me to think about my neighbor who has contributed to that. And, okay, maybe I can't pay 100% of the AP because I still want to take a very conservative posture here. But maybe I pay 5%, maybe I pay 10%, because they're dealing with the same issues and maybe they haven't been anywhere near as successful as I have, and I actually need them to remain in business, because come September, October, November, I'm really going to need them, and I'm going to need them to think well of me. And so that would be a suggestion, too. I'm not saying that we go from one extreme to the other. I think it obviously pays to be very prudent, but I do think that everyone should be asking the question, who can I pay 5, 10% of what I owe to today, who would probably appreciate something versus nothing? Just a suggestion. Roy, Steve, I'm going to go a little bit off script right in this situation because there's something I think that it's worth mentioning that has come up a bunch, and I think you have some experience to speak through it. I know, Steve, you and I talked about this a little bit the other day, is that the push and pull of, you know, getting a bolus of money, some of which are grant dollars that are essentially, you know, to the extent that you comply with the terms and conditions, free money to a practice, right? You know, dealing with the push and pull of practitioners who are normally paid on a, you know, personal production basis, and because their practices are closed down, you know, there's no personal production, right? And so they'd like their piece of, for lack of a better term, right, the pie when it comes to these federal funds that have been received from different sources. If you could, and now here's where my question comes in, if you could speak to kind of the, and Roy, I'll use your term that you just used, right, the prudent nature of, you know, how do we use these funds compared to the real interest in the professionals, you know, sort of wanting their piece of the pie.
Yeah, I think, Gary, what you're describing there is that the many different stakeholders of a provider platform, all of whom might require some kind of funding from staff to lenders to third parties to professionals. And so how do you share that funding between them in a way that's equitable and maintains, if not increases goodwill versus doing the opposite? Is that what you're getting at?
Exactly.
Yeah, Steve, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well. I don't think there's one answer. You know, obviously you give it to X. I think the way to avoid a negative outcome here is not to assume too much, right? Not to assume that a physician 65 years of age who's been in practice for 30 years must be in good financial shape and obviously plan for this global pandemic and should be last on the list of priorities. And similarly, don't assume that a low-wage employee is easily replaceable and therefore can be ignored. I think the important point is to get feedback from everyone. Hopefully you have a group with a lot of very honest voices and, frankly, a lot of leaders who are offering to make concessions as opposed to the opposite. And hopefully as a collective, you start to allocate this kind of emergency funding in a somewhat equitable way. I'm not sure that's always possible. It really depends on the culture of the organization and the individuals involved. I can only hope that going into a crisis like this, people have partnered with good partners, because this is one of those times where those decisions and those partnerships are really being tested. But I think one key suggestion, at least from my end, would be don't assume too much and do the work.
Yeah. Steve, anything to add to that?
Well, I'd reiterate my comment earlier about trust-based relationships and making sure they're authentic and they're deep. Because if you have that, your chance of getting through this super sensitive subject that you just raised, Ari, you got a better chance of being successful. And my approach in these times when income, earnings are at stake, first and foremost, you become very empathetic. And you're never going to be applauded as being fair to everybody, because everybody has their own perception of what they need, what they deserve, what they're entitled to. And number one, whatever decision you make here on who gets what, do it by position or level of employee. And the cuts need to start at the top with management and the physician providers. And making sure as you make your decisions of who gets what piece of this precious pie, that each level in your mind as a responsible manager, board member, you have enough for each level of employee to survive. And it's not what I deserve or what I'm entitled to, but make the very best judgment you can. And it's not I deserve X dollars or percentage of my, you know, last 100 days of income or my last W-2, but really working through level by level. And the higher levels typically are the higher wage earners, and they should be prepared to accept more sacrifice through this whole journey to keep the team together. And you got to lead by example at and close to the top.
Also, you'll get a chance within an organization to treat this change somewhat similarly to all change within these organizations, which is who's the early adopter, who are the examples that you're going to share with others. Change is always adopted sequentially based on who's early, who's following the early adopter, and who's the most cynical and most resistant. And typically, you get into a quagmire when you approach the most resistant audience first, or when you even include them and expect from them early adoption. And so I'll give you an analogy that gets a lot of press, and I focus on it because I'm from that part of the world. You know, the soccer industry has the Premier League and has the Spanish League, the Italian League, and you hear about different soccer players. It is analogous because they're very well paid. Some of whom volunteer to take enormous pay cuts, you know, 70% wage reduction, volunteering, very well publicized, and some of whom haven't been answering phone calls. They're just not available to take any pay cuts. And in the same time, you have a large FTE base supporting these clubs, many of whom have been furloughed, many of whom have been fired, and many of whom have been forced to take massive pay reductions. And so this big dichotomy or disparity between income levels and how they've been asked to sacrifice is very prevalent there and widely publicized. So it is interesting to know where you do have leadership, you know, a physician or two or three or four or five who are really stepping up and showing the rest of their peers what sacrifice for the greater good and what investing in the future of the business really looks like. That can then have a ripple effect if handled appropriately. It's still very difficult. I don't think it's one of those exercises where everyone walks away thrilled, but it's a case of minimizing damage.
Yeah. Let's pivot. Some of the questions that we've been getting relate to this, and we were going to ourselves pivot to this anyway. So let's pivot and talk about some of the important issues when the sun breaks through the clouds, right? When we start to hear about opportunity for some of these managed practices to open or to scale up and those types of things. So, Steve, what's the sort of what needs to get done to prepare for reopening?
A lot. The first thing I would be addressing is building three ramping, reopening financial models. And I call it good, better, and best in my optimistic point of view as we prepare for the future. But one financial model to anticipate the future isn't enough. We just can't predict. We can't assume with one model what's going to happen when we reopen. And it will require some type of ramping and staging and feathering of the organization as we ramp back up. And this is a complex challenge. And as you look at your assumptions, really understanding what's the new provider-patient capacity. What's it going to look like? And we got to be realistic. And no matter how realistic we are, things are going to happen, and we're going to be off the mark, and we got to be able to pivot to a couple different plans if we're off the mark, because we've got to match to the best of our ability staffing payroll, that's the physicians, the providers, and all the supporting staff, with the patient demand, patient appointments. Is it just an exam? Is it a treatment? Is it surgery? And looking at how you match revenue and supporting expense. And that primary supporting expense, as we all know, is payroll. And these three models of good, better, best are really important, and get the right minds engaged with the right assumptions to put this together. And the models can't be just for 3-4 months. They've got to go out 16-18 months. They've got to get us through every month of 2021, because we just don't know how long it's going to take to ramp up to whatever the new volume in each of these businesses, each of these practices is going to become. And some practices may never get back to the old volumes. And we just can't expect lights on, doors open, cities are open, and everybody comes back, and it's going to be back to the good old days. That is highly, highly unrealistic. And there might be some people, as Roy mentioned earlier, that don't want to come back because of a patient's safety perception, can't come back because of childcare. So there's a lot of elements here. So having three different models, I subscribe to making sure you got three arrows in your quiver, so to speak. But also start thinking through who gets rehired when. And it needs to be a major point of discussion, and it will become contentious among management and providers. Because a lot of providers want to come back full-time right away, you might not need them. You might not need two of the same types of provider in the same clinic. And do they each come back part-time? Does one come back a month later? And then they press you and say, well, this is what my employment agreement states. So really thinking through who comes back when and who is willing to come back and not willing. It's a complex chess game that you got to really think through with the right minds in the organization. And I can't emphasize enough, matching P&L expenses and cash flow forecasts with your patient visits and your billings and collections. And I think Roy mentioned earlier, you know, you got to think this through. So a patient shows up, you examine them, you treat them, you send the bill in, but there's maybe another 24, 44, 64, 70 days before you get the reimbursement from the commercial carrier or from Medicare. And then it might be another 2 weeks before it goes through payroll processing where the actual money's deposited in the provider or employee account. So all of that has to be carefully considered, and all the key stakeholders need to understand how that works. And the other piece is, when you look at these models, do you need any working capital to support the ramp up? There may not be enough cash on the balance sheet. There may not be enough elasticity in negotiated AP terms. Your AR days may go out. You may not be able to tap into that revolver anymore. So really understanding what your working capital needs are to support these ramp up models is mission critical. And then on the human element side, take the time to evaluate your providers, your staff members, to determine if any changes need to be made to strengthen each clinic team. And the same exercise, in my opinion, applies for the functional departments, if it's accounting, HR, IT, whatever. And then if time permits, look at updating your job descriptions, your roles, responsibilities, and there may be an opportunity to fine-tune compensation and benefit plans as well.
Yes.
Roy, did you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great answer, Stephen. It's just so much depth to it, and it's such good advice. I'm going to follow it myself. Let me try to simplify a little bit some of the core principles, because I think this is one of those times where as we reopen, the reopening is going to be harder than the social distancing, because the social distancing was very binary, very reductive. Don't go to work unless you meet the following 10 descriptions of essential businesses. And, you know, that still left plenty of room for complexity, and we spent most of this phone call on that complexity. But fundamentally, it's pretty binary. Lots of patients not showing up. The go back to work, and this is why we're writing about it, and frankly, we're going to be spending some time advising on it and working with management teams to unpack it, is fraught with complexity. It's a really long list of issues. And it's actually the exact antithesis of what our president is promoting. And love him or hate him, that's not my point. My point is that there's nothing V about this from an operational standpoint. And our interest is always in the operations. Even going through the legal complexities of liability and OSHA and CDC and requirements versus guidance, all that new language that's heading our way, all it needs operational solutions. You know, it's one thing to say you need protective gear. It's another thing to qualify how much, who gets to use it, under what circumstances. Are you measuring people for fever, privacy issues, training, staff, oversight, reporting? There's no such thing as doing something without those core verbs. And so there's complexity everywhere we look. The behavioral component of this, the interpersonal component, there's a lot of people coming back to work that are very different than the people you thought you knew 3-4 months ago. They've seen loved ones lose their lives over this in horrific ways, in hospitals where no one got a chance to say goodbye, with missing details. There's people that have seen their children react very poorly to this. We have no idea what any one of the individuals that we interact with has had to live through over the past 60, 90 days. And just because any one of us might feel like we're ready to work doesn't mean that the individuals that we're partnered with feel the same way. So there's a whole slew of complexities on, you know, just how to deal with interpersonal going forward. And, I mean, I think the good news is that the primary recommendation from us is the same for all of these issues. Scheduling patients, creating a safe work environment, having staff not respond to what they see with, oh, I guess my employer was just itching to get back to work and, you know, our safety be damned, and patients reacting that same way. And, you know, you don't want to be that Delta Airlines flight that was packed or that MTA train that was packed, no one wearing masks. You don't want to be that hospital that, you know, was asking staff to wear dustbin bags, whether it's true or not. You don't want to be that company, and society as a whole in the go back to work is going to be looking for those examples to point a finger at and say, don't do that. So I would say don't underestimate how much brand matters, perception matters, even in the most local and small village. In every village, people talk and they talk and identity gets set, and you want to have a good identity versus a bad one. These things are very difficult to change over time. So again, the primary recommendation for everything, patient scheduling, how you go about changing your infrastructure, your workplace, if you change it at all, understanding that your entire ecosystem is going through the same get back to work complexities. As Steve mentioned, your biller is going through this. Your IT department, if it's outsourced, is going through this. your insurance provider, your malpractice provider is going through this. There's no one that you deal with. Verizon, who provides you with a phone system, is going through this, who isn't distracted by a significant impairment to supply and complexity attached to it. So that God bless the president for whatever reasons you want to bless him. This doesn't feel very V to me. And I think the one advice I would give everyone is tread cautiously and carefully and delicately. You don't want to be the first to rush in here. You don't want to be the Georgia. And you similarly don't want to be the last. We're all in a competitive environment, and there is a punishment for moving too slowly and doing nothing, whilst prudent response requires doing at least something. So I think it is a case of in every step that these businesses take, bringing back staff, renegotiating contracts, solving for funding. The one thing you don't want to do is tell the story that the second half of this year is going to compensate for the very weak second quarter. Because I think in most cases, you almost don't want it to. That would be a bad sign.
Roy, thank you. Anything going to change about how we compensate our professionals as a result of all of this? And either one of you. Any thoughts on that?
Well, other than there being probably less volume and resources, you're asking the question from the structural.
Yeah. I mean, are we going to change? Is it going to change how professionals get compensated?
Well, I'll offer a few thoughts there. I'll buy Steve some time. Some of the anomalies that we saw over the last 90 days are, you know, what is the definition of essential within healthcare? And all kinds of things reveal themselves to us. Groups that did relatively okay for different reasons, from oncology, obviously dialysis infusion, elements of pharma, elements of women's health, the obstetrics part, elements of physical therapy, elements of home care, you know, essential procedures within retina, pain, cardio. I mentioned ER management, although obviously they gave up some volume. Neuro, clearly primary care. Two that were very interesting to me and unexpected to some extent, because I just didn't think about it in that context, were no-fault workers' comp, whose volume remained pretty strong for patients that needed essential care, and despite the fear of being in an infectious environment, still persevered because they had personal financial incentives for doing so as patients, which is very unusual for healthcare, but does exist in that space. And the other was value-based care, where I had reports of sponsor-owned assets that had a very strong march. And I do think that's going to be looked at in retrospect. You know, why is it that at-risk reimbursements rewarded providers and platforms for doing nothing, whereas hospital systems were financially destroyed for taking on the biggest personal risk and for doing the most, actually, to try to tackle this crisis. So I think that's a big question that's going to be asked. I think if you break it down further, fee-for-service reimbursement, W-2 wages, MSO partnership models. I'm not sure. I haven't gone into that level of thought to make the connection between this crisis and those forms of payment. Or if you had more of an idea behind the question, let me know.
Yeah, no. It's really a question that we got from the audience just about whether or not we thought the comp models would change. You know, look, go ahead, Steve.
One thing that I do think I'm really pleased about is, you know, we wrote a piece that we published first week of March called America, U.S. Healthcare Not Broken, Just Needs Improvement. Because if you remember, the 12 months leading up to this was the presidential campaign amongst Democratic candidates, and the largest topic they focused on was U.S. healthcare broken, championed by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and then supported by a lot of other House representatives. And you know, we wrote a long piece with four or five core themes to explain why it's not broken. You know, the comparison to Sweden was an unfair comparison. And we published it in early March knowing that U.S. healthcare was about to be tested in ways that it's never been tested since its formation. Just unprecedented levels of madness. And we're proud that we did that. We did have comparisons that we thought would be crystallized or at least further strengthened between U.S. healthcare and the rest of the world. We did write about that, too, in our first COVID piece, that this would really highlight to a lot of us strengths and weaknesses from one country to the next in their healthcare systems that we otherwise ignored or just superficially relied on journalists over here to tell us what's good and what's bad, and reading a lot of their analytics, it was very superficial. So I think we're getting an education in healthcare in South Korea, healthcare in Taiwan, healthcare in Germany, healthcare in Italy, healthcare in the UK that today has the highest levels of mortality all across Europe, which, by the way, we predicted in early March, knowing that system quite well. The one silver lining that I'm taking from this is I don't think that the 7 p.m. standing ovations in New York for everyone in healthcare, especially providers, is a small thing. It continues every day. And it is, if you were thinking about it, something that the industry was desperately lacking, undeservedly so, on the back of, you know, 30 years of journalists in this country telling the story that everyone in healthcare is grossly overpaid. So there may be some change, but I'm not sure that the directional change is going to be as straightforwardly down as it's been over the last 30 years, other than for the fact that our government probably has a lot less money to work with over the next 10 years.
Yeah. Right. Thank you. Steve, anything to add?
All right. I'll keep my comments brief so we can maybe get to some questions. I'll take a little different tact, and I'd focus on a compensation internally in these provider organizations. Because there are external payers that have different points of view on what medically necessary or elective procedures are worth paying for. And there's different contracts, negotiations, and some are medical, some are surgical. But the other compensation that we need to look at is internal. And how do providers, if it's a physician, if it's an NP, a PA, an RN, an MA, how do they get paid for the services and the value they provide? And at a very high level, I think this is a good opportunity to look at how compensation is constructed from a variable or a fixed basis and how that could be changed to the mutual benefit of all stakeholders. And if it's more variable, what are the production metrics used to pay variable compensation that is fair and equitable?
It's a big question. I mean, there's many different elements to it, right? We've got 30 million and growing previously employed individuals with health insurance that may be transitioning over to government reimbursement. There's lots of moving parts here. So it's going to be interesting to observe. You've also got, you know, education in what was essential versus not manifesting at the patient level. I just spent 3 months and I didn't visit the ER once. Maybe I'll stick to that new program for me. Lots of change in behavior. Is telemedicine going to change the frequency of procedures? Is it really going to play this preventative role that everyone has been forecasting that it's perfectly geared to do now that it's growing at the rate that it's growing? I always, with healthcare, take the approach that Mark Twain always recommended, because I think it's so true for healthcare, which is most people don't know the difference between good news and bad news. And I include myself in that category. A platform develops three new revenue streams that it fully invests in during this crisis, and its old revenue streams become antiquated and don't reimburse its providers the same way anymore, but its three new revenue streams are transformational. That's not bad news. That's good news. Your platform is now more relevant to the current times that we're in and better equipped to survive the future. You've just transitioned from antiquated to modern. Congratulations. It didn't feel that way while it was happening. It felt like the world was caving in around you. But you did what you needed to do to survive, and then you thrived. So we don't know the answer yet on the thriving. Everyone is focused on the surviving, it sounds like, for now.
Yeah, some parting thoughts on this particular issue, which is, right before we started to have shelter-in-place orders, lots of interest in physician practice management transactions, lots of interest in rolling up professional practices. Once the coast is clear, do these transactions continue to be interesting? Do we continue to see lots of consolidations? Do we see consolidations between some of the big players in this space? Let's use that question as our sort of parting question as we get towards the end of our talk today. Steve, why don't we start with you?
Yes, I believe this crisis will accelerate the activity among buyers, sellers, lenders, advisors, and many of those activities leading to transactions. Virtually every specialty that I'm aware of remains highly fragmented, and there are many PE-sponsored platforms and independent practices that today, now more than ever, need strengthen leadership. They need better support infrastructure. They need increased patient volume and perhaps capital. So this consolidation opportunity, I think, is real. And I think the level of activity will definitely pick up in the months to come. These elements support the thesis for mergers of platforms and tuck-in acquisitions, but you really have to think through very, very practically, is this a really sound investment thesis? And to your point, Ari, you said there may be some PE-sponsored platforms and a common specialty that merge. And thinking through how that works, it's bigger, it's more complex. But I think that type of activity will also increase in volume in time to come. The other thing we got to remember, consolidation and size just don't guarantee success. But the platforms with the right leadership, the right support infrastructure, right clinical staff, and the right working and growth capital will really, really have an advantage. And the activity, we've seen a lot of new platforms come into being with PE sponsorship, lots of tuck-in acquisitions coming in to expand these platforms. But the thing I'm most keen on is these larger platforms that have evolved over the past year or several years of consolidating. I think there's a big, big opportunity created coming out of this pandemic. And then last but not least, execution of the business model among management, the physicians, the staff is more important than ever to support whatever private equity sponsor investment thesis.
Yes, I would say in terms of M&A activity, you've got maybe two phases to it. You've got a trickle of sponsors who are interested in looking at assets today, maybe even entering exclusivity today, subject to a return to somewhat normal tomorrow. And I think that's very healthy. I applaud them for doing that. Get close, be on the front line, be an early adopter of the return to investment. Obviously, it's a little bit easier to deal with those platforms that are somewhat unaffected over the last 60, 90 days. And there's a good group out there. So that's interesting. Let me go buy an infusion business. Then there's sort of phase two of what happens when we are somewhat back to normal, and what does the buying community do in that stage that's waiting for us, call it an end of the year, second half, fourth quarter, and then beginning, starting 2021, assuming there isn't a massive second wave. And I think that you've got lenders and investors who are going to be asking the question, nationally, what is the lesson that we took away from this? Is it that every time that there's a national crisis like this, and there may be others like this, is the shutdown option as a pretty quick reaction, a winning formula? Or is it something that in hindsight with research, we realized was a rush? And do we learn with every month that passes that the consequences were far greater than we imagined? And is the collective lesson that we learn, Congress enacts restrictions that prevent us from doing this again? And I think our industry is going to require many different layers of protection. And I would add that one to the list. We're going to need protection in terms of what it means to employ people and treat and service people in what's just become a very hazardous environment. And we're going to need protection from this binary on-off switch that's just been introduced into the psyche that, frankly, hasn't existed in 250 years. So if that switch isn't provided, if that security isn't provided, then you're going to have a lot of lenders who tap out, you know, in excess of 3 times, 4 times is going to seem high risk. And you're going to have a lot of sponsors that will tap out, you know, in excess of 9, 10 times. And then the question is, who's doing a deal at 9, 10 times EBITDA trailing? And I think that's what's going to prove interesting. I think there is going to be a lot more discipline in terms of what buyers are willing to pay. And I think there are going to be plenty of sellers that are going to be just as interested in forming these partnerships at 9, 10 times as they were at 12, 13, 14, 16, 18, most recently in January, 20 times signed LOI. And so I think we transitioned from any price is fine. I have to be an owner and I can manufacture those through future acquisitions, whether they're dilutive or not, at least I'm in the game, to a much more disciplined buyer universe and a very receptive seller universe. And I think that does translate to maybe a disconnect from annual increases in transaction fees for investment bankers. I think if you ask most bankers, and I know a good number of them and respect a good number of them greatly, 2017 was a record year. 2018 was a new record year. 2019 was a new record year. I think it's going to be a while before we go back to that environment. But I've always campaigned on other metrics. You know, I do think there's going to be much better fit transactions going forward over the next 2 or 3 years with groups that do actually belong together, spend a lot more time getting to know each other. And I think our industry will be better off for it. I don't know that we necessarily have to do deals of 14 times. It might represent a smaller dollar aggregate number, sort of $80 billion of M&A 2019 in physician practice transactions. Maybe it's $40 billion, but some people look at that and say, well, that's a disaster. I'm following a different metric. You know, how many of those platforms blew up 3 years down the road versus how many of them developed into phenomenal national brands that everyone knows and respects?
Yeah, I tend to agree. Roy, Steve, we've gone a bit over our time. I want to wrap it up and say thank you to everybody who joined us today. I really appreciate Roy and Steve, a virtual round of applause for your discussion today. It really was wonderful. Thank you for taking the time to talk through some of these issues that we have in physician practice management investments. Again, and thank you for everyone for joining us today. We appreciate you coming in to hear our webinar, and be well, be safe, and take care. Thanks so much. Bye.